Hey, welcome to the Protectors. Excellent, excellent guest today, Mark Cameron. We're going to talk about his book, Bone Rattle. But before we get there, let me give you, I want to give a big shout out to Deliver Fund. Deliver Fund is doing a lot to end human trafficking. They're on the front lines. They're not some quasi paramilitary group. They're actually providing data analytics and training and intel analysis for the people on the front lines, for law enforcement, for other agencies. So please check out deliverfund.org. Mark, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Jason.
Happy to have you back on. So just everybody knows that I had Mark on before. We had an excellent conversation. We're talking all sorts of things about guns and everything else. And then I had a corrupt data file, and we lost that interview. So Mark, apologies and welcome back.
No worries. It's great to come back and chat with you again.
You've had a heck of a career. Let's talk about your law enforcement career.
Okay. Yeah, well, I started
in the, let's get the 30,000 foot overview of your law enforcement career.
Yeah, so I started in local law enforcement in a small town, the town I went to high school in, Weatherford, Texas, just west of Fort Worth, and was a police officer there, patrol officer, mounted patrol, horseback patrol officer, department diver, ended up being a detective for a couple of years, and eventually it moved on to the United States Marshal Service, where I spent the bulk of my career, about not quite 23 years with the Marshal Service.
I tell you, one thing I miss is fugitive apprehensions. I miss having that, you know, that target set where you're like, huh, let's go find this guy or girl.
Yep. I miss it too. Been retired 8 years now, and there's not a day that goes by. I joke, but it's really true that, you know, people will say, man, you've achieved your dream of your ultimate dream of being a novelist full time. And that's true. And I posit that that's the second best job in the world. And that the one I held before was, for me anyway, the best job in the world is a deputy U.S. Marshal.
I think it was 19. I graduated in 97 from college. No, 99 in college. But when I went to college in 97, I used to have this poster. And back then, you used to have to mail away for like recruitment brochures and all that. Mm-hmm. And I had a poster. It's like, put a star on your future. And it was like the U.S. Yeah. Marshals. And I'm like, that's the coolest thing, man.
I remember folded. It was like a tri-fold out kind of cardboard. Yeah, I used to hand those out. My trunk was full of those.
Oh, I used to have it hanging on my wall. It was awesome.
Yep. Yep.
I went through the process with the Marshals back in the early 2000s, because I was already in the 1811, and I was trying to find a job with DOJ so I can get closer to home. Mm-hmm. And went through the whole process with the U.S. Marshals. And I'm like, I wonder whatever happened to that application. This is about a year later. So I call up the applicant coordinator, whoever the HR person was. She goes, let me see here. Oh, how come you didn't get a job in offer? And I'm like, I don't know. She goes, do you want to go to Brooklyn? And I'm like, yeah, no thanks. I think I'm good here. And I'm just like, just random.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's kind of the whole lateral move thing, lateral 1811 thing, went back and forth for a while. It would be sometimes we would take them, sometimes we wouldn't. It was weird.
Yeah, it was funny. But yeah, law enforcement, that's where it's at. And now you're writing books, and I haven't read Bone Rattle yet. I need to really jump into your whole series, because I tell you, I have so many books. I think this is going to be our next book club selection next month. So if anybody out there is interested, we have the Protectors Book Club. Tell us about Arliss Cutter.
Well, you know, I started writing, actually started writing Westerns years ago, and mistakenly thinking, well, that'll be an easy way to break in. And, I actually started writing short stories and got stacks and stacks of rejection letters back when you used to get self-addressed stamped envelopes with little notes in them saying thanks, but no thanks. But, now it's all email or simply just ghosting you and you never hear. But got a lot of rejection letters, and honestly, I don't understand why my wife put up with me coming home from work and spending a couple hours in the room, other room, writing, you know, either on the typewriter in the beginning or on the computer. But I finally got some short stories published, got some Westerns published, ghostwritten for another author at first, and then my own. And then I kind of decided through my agent, I'd picked up a very nice, very well-qualified agent. She's still my agent after 17, almost 18 years now, named Robin Rue with Writer's House in New York. But she suggested, you know, you might want to break away and write something different than Westerns, that, you know, they're more money, they're, you know, wider audience. And so I wrote some novels that were kind of Alaska-centric and law enforcement-centric, and, you know, write what you know kind of a thing. And I was living in Alaska at the time, and nobody would buy them. and I was already published. I already had 6 books to my name published and a couple on the USA Today list, and nobody would buy them. In fact, I got a rejection letter from one of the major houses, and this was like a page and a half rejection letter, and most rejection letters are a line and a half, and it was very nice. I've since met the editor that sent it. He doesn't obviously remember me out of the thousands of rejection letters, but at the end he praised my writing, but then gave me some really good pointers that I had to be honest with myself about. But at the end of the letter, he said, "You should write what you live and even go over the top, give us James Bond, Jason Bourne, you know, suspend our disbelief, that sort of thing." And then he kind of pissed me off at the end by saying, "And anyway, who cares about Alaska? And who cares about a bunch of Alaska Native kids?" And he wasn't saying it in a mean way. It was more like consumers want something different. And this was pre-Sarah Palin, pre-everybody and their dog has a reality show in Alaska. So I moved over and wrote what eventually became the Jericho Quinn series that has 8 full-length novels and 2 novellas in it, and, you know, allowed me to retire at 50 and got a great readership. And then I eventually was able to convince my publisher, "Let me try one of these other ones." And so I repackaged one of the early ones, had written enough to maybe fix the things that this other editor told me. And that became Arliss Cutter. So Arliss Cutter is a supervisory deputy U.S. Marshal in Alaska. He's moved to Alaska to take care of his widowed sister-in-law after his brother's death. It just so happens that he's had a crush on his sister-in-law since they were 16. So there's that tension between them. He's helping her raise her young children. So he's the uncle, but he's got this quasi family, and he's out doing his, kicking butt and taking names, kind of a fugitive hunter kind of a person. And incidentally, along the way, he's a vet. And incidentally, along the way, he's come across some pretty tough times in his life where it's caused him to never suffer a bully, even for an instant, which can get him in trouble pretty quick. It's not that he has an anger management problem, is he has a bully management problem, and he just will not put up with any kind of rude behavior towards someone else. Towards him, he's water off a duck's back, but to someone else, it's instantaneous. That, you know, violence, surprise, and, you know, violence of action, speed, surprise, and violence of action. That's Arliss Cutter.
What's the deal with the antagonist? How do you, like with marshals, this is your life, going after one specific target, you get them, doesn't matter if they, what their crime was, whatever, you're going after them. Now, how do you work in the antagonist with this series?
That's a good question. I think in order to have a strong protagonist, you got to have a smart, bad antagonist. And the cool thing about the Marshal Service as a job and as a milieu for a book is that we have the broadest authority of any federal agency, in that our credential just says enforce federal law. So there's no code, or, you know, U.S. code 18 U.S.C. whatever. It just says enforce federal law. And so that allows us, when we're out on a fugitive op in Bristol Bay, you know, Western Alaska or Southwest Alaska, or up in the bush in Northern Alaska or Southeast Alaska. When we're there on some other matter, if the very, you know, understaffed law enforcement in that area has something big happen, then we roll in and assist them because we have the authority and the, you know, the jurisdiction to do it. And that happens all the time. Now, obviously I play it up in the books and it doesn't happen to one or two deputies through their whole career a million times. But, you know, I mean, in Murder, She Wrote, if there's that many murders in one small New England town, the FBI would come looking, you know. So a lot of stuff happens to our list, and I picked and I've all the things that have happened in the first four books, three of them are out, one's coming next year, but it's already written and with the publisher, have either happened in some form or fashion to me or people that I've known. And so whether it's murder, and generally because it's a mystery, it's some sort of murder. So obviously the marshals don't go around investigating murders as a matter of course, although we do arrest a lot of murderers. So it's been, you know, I knew I wanted to write. I was writing already when I got on with the marshals, and I kind of treated, you know, as a junior deputy, as a young, you know, pod, a plain old deputy, POD, you do a lot of prisoner transport, especially where I was in Texas. We were near the Oklahoma border, and so we got a lot of sedan trips up to El Reno, Oklahoma, and then when I was in Idaho, over to Sheridan, Oregon, to the FCI there, and then to meet the airlift. So I was on the road a lot, and not in a van, but in a blue, one of those crazy blue Caprices that look like Shamu, you know, the goofy looking model of Caprice, and with a cage in it, with one or two prisoners for 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. And so I just listened. I just took notes and listened and got their stories and their, you know, I don't base any one character off any one person, but certainly I pick and choose the moods and the, you know, try to make my characters real three-dimensional people.
I tell you, like, real life experience is like a master's class. It's like you don't need to go and learn from some college professor to get a degree or anything else. I mean, help somewhere in there. But listening to stories like that, you really, they're exposing you to things you could possibly never imagine. It's that must have been really cool just to kind of absorb all that and continue that on with these character sets.
No, it was a blast. I remember a guy that we had arrested him on a parole violation, and, you know, federal parole was abolished before I even came on with the Marshal Service, but there were still parolees out there. So people that had, you know, now it's supervised release. But back then there were still people on parole. They'd been let out by a parole board. And if they violated that parole, there was, you know, do not pass go, do not go see the judge. If you violate parole, you're back to prison. And so as a deputy marshal, it was a very kind of a quick catch because you, and I don't mean to demean the people because everybody's human and we treat them human. But as far as the actual work of a deputy marshal, when you arrest a parole violator, it was hook them and haul them. You just went to their house, you got them. If there was a parole warrant, and you took them back to the nearest prison, the, you know, Federal Correctional Institution or USP. And so, or put them on an airlift to go back to where they were supposed to go. And we got this guy, it was a white collar crime. I can't remember what, some sort of embezzlement. And it was in Plano, you know, near Dallas. And we went and got him early, early, early in the morning. Kind of, you go kind of in between the time when, you know, dogs go to sleep and people wake up so that nobody, you know, everybody's asleep. Mm-hmm. And knocked on his door. It wasn't a no knock or anything. Like I said, it was a white collar in a beautiful area of Plano, brick house, nice Beamer in the driveway. He answered the door in his robe, kind of, yeah, got a DUI. I knew you were coming. I violated parole. He's the only one of two prisoners, by the way, arrestees, that I ever let hug his child goodbye, because that really can put you in a bind if they grab it and won't let go. Mm-hmm. But he just seemed like you could tell he was a decent guy that had made some errors. And so we were taking him back to prison. He's kind of a big dude. And as we were taking him back to Siegelville, which is in Fort Worth, the closer we got, he just changed. And I'm driving, and my partner's in the with the cage, so we both sat in the front seat. And I had the mirror so I could see them in the back or see him in the back. And the closer we got to prison, he just sort of puffed up like a horned toad, you know, how they just get their eyes look like they're going to bleed. Yeah. And like I say, he was a super nice guy when we first arrested him. And I asked him if he was okay. I said, "You all right? What's going on back there?" Cause he started breathing bad. And he said, "No, I'm fine. I'm fine. I just got to put on my prison face." He said, "I won't survive unless I put on my prison face." And I remembered that and wrote it down, and it's helped me. Just chatting with him has helped me in several books as far as character.
Yeah, that's transport is one of those things, man, where you're really, when you've been on the other side, when you've been wearing a badge for so long, and I'm preaching in a choir here, but this is more for the audience, is like when you've been wearing a badge for so long, in the beginning, you kind of don't look at criminals. You look at them as like, oh, they're bad. They all got to be bad criminals. But then after a while, you see there's a human behind it. And there's always human factors. Well, yes, there are evil people out there, but a lot of times there's just humans, you know.
No,
just,
and I would say that it's a lot of times, most of the time, it's just humans. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, in my experience in 30 years, I could count on two hands and one foot the number of evil people. That's a judgment call.
Yeah,
people have done evil things, certainly, but as far as just I want to eat someone's soul kind of evil. That's a rarity. Now that's the person that I write about in the books generally, with kind of minions that do bad things, but they're not necessarily evil. But yeah, and I think the Marshal Service, and my youngest son is a Anchorage police officer here in Alaska. And so I know about their training, and my oldest son was an OSI agent for a number of years with Air Force OSI, Office of Special Investigations, and training. Also went to FLETC, which was kind of cool to know my kid was going to FLETC where I went. So Federal Law Enforcement Training Center for your viewers. But it was encouraging to see that they taught what you just said, that it's a people business. We have to be careful. We have to be, you know, keep law enforcement, keep personal security, you know, personal security and safety and officer safety in mind, but we're dealing with people. Mm-hmm. And the more you think about that, as a law enforcement officer and as a writer, you get some insight. Like we used to have this diagram, even when I was going through in 91 in Marshal Service Basic, we had this diagram with two lines, and on one line, on the one end of the line was the arrest time, and on the other end of the line was the getting them to jail. And as you know, when you arrest someone, as the law enforcement officer, you're the highest of your anxiety level, and the arrestee is at their lowest because they didn't know it was coming generally. As you get closer to the jail, you start to relax, and the arrestee starts to get more anxious. And so from officer safety standpoint, you realize, okay, this is the most dangerous time, apart from just the laying on of hands. This is the most dangerous time as far as escape, because especially like almost at jail, if you have to, in some jails, you have to park out front and walk them across the parking lot. Knowing that about human nature helps you be safer, but then writing that also helps you come up with some pretty cool scenes as far as reality.
Yeah. You always have to have that conflict, like at least seven series of conflict within a book, but yeah. And you know, I wish they still taught that. They didn't teach it. When I went through FLETC, it was January 2000. And they never really taught us about that. When you go to drop someone off from after you process them, you bring them out and you, drop them off. They don't teach you about that.
Yeah, I don't know what other agencies do. The Marshal Service, because we're such a custodial agency, they drill that in you pretty hard. In fact, we spend a considerable amount of time in handcuffs behind bars and being, I don't think they still do it just because of I don't know, legal issues or whatever, but we used to have to get, we got strip searched during the academy by, you know, the same gender folks, but it is, it certainly lets you realize when you're strip searching somebody, how invasive it is. You understand a little better when you've had to go through it yourself. And I'm glad that they had us spend time cuffed in the back of a car in our, you know, three-piece suit, the leg irons, waist chain, handcuffs, because then you understand what it's like. And, you know, you never want to have it done to you. You're never going to do the, you know, give me your gun and put these handcuffs on kind of a thing with somebody if they ever get the drop on you.
I tell you what, I'm really looking forward to this series now even more that you're bringing back a lot of memories for me with like Fletzy and everything else and investigations and fugitives. I'm really excited to check out Arliss and to see what his journey is like and to see what his antagonists are like. That's really cool.
Thanks. I appreciate it. It's fun. And it has a lot. Alaska is such a big character. The first one, Open Carry, is sit down in Southeast Alaska on a little island. It's actually the third largest island in the United States. It's called Prince of Wales Island. Well, I was on the, what we call the tactical tracking unit, a rural man tracking unit when I was in, fairly new up here, led by my jiu-jitsu sensei, Ty Cunningham, and he's a master tracker, great guy. Anyway, he was out of town, as luck would have it, and a guy down in Prince of Wales chopped another guy's head off with a splitting maul and then fled into the woods. And so the troopers and Craig is the name of the town down there, Craig Police Department, called and asked if we could come help. So we got on the state plane, flew down. We were down there just in a matter of hours and spent several days in these old growth forests with, you know, with totem poles and strong Tlingit and Haida native culture. And I knew right then I was going to set it up. And that was 20 years ago. And I knew right then I was going to set a book here. And that book became Open Carry and the first Arliss Cutter book. The next book takes place out in Western Alaska on the Yukon and Kuskokwim River Delta, Yupik native cultures and small villages. I spent a lot of time out there. Bone Rattle takes place in Juneau, which is the capital of Alaska, more urban, although, you know, not really. It's, you know, a small town, except when cruise ships pull in and 30,000 people disgorge and become the, you know, double the size of the city. But so I'm able to bounce around Alaska and show some of the different cultures. I like to put in native cultures. Arliss's partner is a Pacific Islander, a Cook Island Maori named Lola Te Ariki. My wife and I spend a couple of months every year on the island of Rarotonga. And we have wonderful friends there. I do quite a bit of writing there. I write the bulk of one. I usually finish an Arliss and really write the bones of a Clancy while we're on Rarotonga. And so I've modeled some of my friends, modeled Lola after some of my friends, and that strong Maori Polynesian woman. And so it's fun. It's really fun. I'm able to explore a lot of stuff in these books that I'm not able to do in the sort of the wham bam, you know, terrorist hunting Jericho Quinn books, which are fun in their own way, but these are a little different.
Well, especially now that you bring up the tracking, man, that is one thing I miss the most from being a Border Patrol agent is tracking. I love it. I miss it. And I'm going to see how Arliss is. I'm going to see. Okay. I'm checking out, Mark. I know you've been doing that tactical tracking back in the day. Yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah, actually, the guy that taught me learned from Border Patrol. So, yeah. And then just living in, most of us that were on the team tracked from the time we were young. We just didn't have the nomenclature.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Feel free to check it out.
I will. Mark, I appreciate you coming on. Everybody, Bone Rattle is out now. And Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks a million. Take care.